Hello everybody. Today I am going to be talking about the things that I deliberately kept secret for the majority, well, up until now, really. It feels like every time I do a new episode, I feel ready and more willing to talk about the very, very shameful stuff. The stuff that I didn't want anyone to know about for a long time. And it's feeling more and more important, partly because it's only thanks to the efforts of others being truthful and being open about experiences like this. Although they might sometimes be adults talking about their children, which I have mixed feelings about, but it's only because of them that I'm able to actually start piecing together the riddles and the mysteries and the secrets of my own life. And even though I found out that I'm autistic 2 years ago, it's only relatively recently that I found out really what dyspraxia is and have managed to piece together how some of the things I find most difficult and most disabling actually fall into the category of dyspraxia rather than autism, which is helpful because I kind of assumed that everything I experience and everything I find difficult was just, you know, straight up autism, probably some inattentive ADHD. Actually, I'm not even so sure anymore about the ADHD because my issues with working memory and being able to plan and execute sequenced steps in a task do seem to be explained by dyspraxia. Anyway, that's not what today's episode is about. Separate to all of the things that were straightforwardly autism and now probably dyspraxia, I also have got a bunch of experiences from my life where I understand that they are probably related to trauma of some sort, but the severity of that trauma response still never really added up in terms of when you actually look at my life. Yes, I was an undiagnosed, unidentified, autistic child and adult. Yes, I really struggled with many aspects of that. I have had a lot of very, very difficult experiences in relationships, in understanding other people and being understood. I'm now understanding a lot about my sensory needs and the trauma. I mean, really seriously, you know, massive trauma impact on my body from not taking care of my sensory needs. But I wasn't bullied. Not seriously. I was controlled, I was harassed, I was picked on, but I did not deal with the horrors of bullying that I know a lot of young autistic people or otherwise neurodivergent people have had to deal with. I had a very controlling parent, my dad, and a sort of a fairly distant, absent mother. But I cannot say, and I don't say that either of my parents were cruel or intentionally abusive towards me. They were very, very complex people. And one was a sort of authoritarian parent, and one was a very kind of permissive, do what you like parent, which was very conflicting and created some, you know, contributed to some very toxic dynamics, and there was major toxicity between the two of them. But, you know, in comparison to what I know a lot of people experienced in their developmental years, you know, I was loved. I was cared for in the ways that my parents believed was the right way to care for me. So it does mean that up until really, you know, now, I have been still struggling to understand why I've had really quite extreme, ongoing, long-term trauma responses. And I think I found the answer. I'm pretty sure I have. I mean, I'm as sure of this as I was of discovering that I'm autistic a couple of years ago. And the answer is in the title of today's podcast episode, and that is internalized PDA, which stands for pathological demand avoidance, but is also being reframed as pervasive drive or desire for autonomy. Both of them work, and I would happily use either of them, to be honest. However, I don't think they do a very good job of describing the internal experience in the same way that I do not believe autism, as it's conceptualized now, does a good job of describing the internal experience. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that today. I have a feeling there are many, 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 many adults using all kinds of very unhealthy coping mechanisms. Some may have figured out healthier coping mechanisms, who are maybe a bit confused by why they need to do the things that they do, and actually might find this concept very useful in the way that I'm finding it useful, which is why I'm talking about it. Okay, so it was only a little while after discovering that I'm autistic and kind of arriving, if you like, into the autistic community, most of which is online, and seeing other people's content, that I even really came across the concept of demand. So, you know, I've often had people comment to me about how much pressure I put myself under, what a high achiever I am, how hard I work. And I think I've always been like, I didn't realise that that was optional. You know, like surprised when people make comments like that, kind of thinking, well, how much pressure am I supposed to put myself under? Presumably there is a certain amount of pressure, but I don't think I realised. I mean, I definitely didn't realise that actually a very high level of demand on myself is kind of my default and my normal. So the concept of demand is all quite new. And I was encountering autistic adults, late diagnosed autistic women in particular, kind of talking about needing a lower demand life, a lower demand job, reducing demands in the home, struggling to balance the demands of parenting and work life. And I'm not a parent, and we'll get to that probably a bit more in a minute. And I was also seeing quite a bit about reducing demands on autistic children, low demands, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh, okay, demand. And then I started to become conscious to how much demand I feel I experience in my life. And I'm aware of the fact that I, for inexplicable until this moment in my life, inexplicable reasons, felt that I could not have children even though I wanted children. And so I don't have any children. So I kind of want to get into a bit of a description of my earlier life now and the stuff that I experienced and the stuff that I did to cope and stuff that I've hidden. Now that I've basically broached the concept of, I didn't really know about demands, so I've never been able to look at my life through the lens of, what demands have I been under? How do I feel about those demands? How do those demands affect me? And putting together, I guess, my new understandings of all that stuff around demand with these very mysterious experiences I had growing up and in my adulthood, that seemed to be an extreme trauma response that was disproportionate to my, you know, observable, objective experience growing up. Okay, so the kinds of things that I experienced that I couldn't, or haven't really been able to attribute just straightforwardly to autism, I have touched on. I've touched on some of these, especially in my episode on sleep and dreams. And it's kind of the stuff that I refer to as my spooky stuff, my spooky experiences. And also the experiences that trigger the most shame in me. I used to hate thinking about myself as a child because I believed for a long time that I was a horrible, horrible child, that I was aggressive, I was mean, I was secretive, I was destructive and secretly destructive. And I've got lots of memories of things that I did as a child that have really stuck with me. And they actually massively overshadow any memory of myself as a caring child or a loving child. I don't remember myself like that at all. I was very, very angry. Incredibly angry. All the time. More angry than could be explained by my circumstances. More angry than could be explained by my sensory needs not being met, you know, not being able to move as much as I wanted to move, wearing uncomfortable clothes. There was like this deep, entrenched, permanent, bubbling, boiling rage in me. And one of the main indicators of this in terms of my day-to-day experiences was from really, really tiny. I definitely remember from like age 3, because I remember where I lived and kind of waking up and trying to make sense of these experiences. I have always had vicious, brutal, graphic, violent nightmares. As a child, I was having nightly graphic images in my dreams of killing people with my hands, with blunt objects, with anything I could get my hands on. And usually the person who featured the most in my dreams, who I was fighting to the death, basically, and who would be fighting me as well, was my dad. So I had to deal with that very, very frequent nightly experience. And I I assumed that those dreams were proportionate to his treatment of me. So I believed from very, very young that my father was a really, really bad person, really dangerous person. And he was complicated. And I'll probably come back to a couple of things about that in a moment. But the point is, everything that I'm about to describe, the only explanation that I ever had for years, right up until now, and he's passed away now, a year and a half ago, the only explanation I had was that my father was a bad person, treated me very badly, by being too controlling, and that it's a result of that that I've kind of got these long-term trauma experiences and rage and anxiety and all of that stuff. And he kind of knew that. He kind of knew that I blamed him. Although he didn't know, and he never knew really the extent of what I was actually experiencing and that I was actually blaming him for. I had extreme rage reactions to anyone in authority, a position of authority, particularly a teacher, or either of my parents, or indeed my older sister, although this was very rare because she was so sweet and gentle always with me. Any other adult, anyone who was running any kind of activity at school, particularly the PE teacher, because PE was such a nightmare for me. Even the people sort of running summer holiday activities. I was in a play a couple of times, the directors of those. I had extreme anger reactions to any interaction with an adult where they were basically telling me off for anything, exerting any kind of control over me or any kind of power over me, to a sort of a seething, feeling extremely violent kind of reaction. And not in the same way to the autistic meltdown that I have as a result of building overstimulation and sensory overwhelm and cognitive overwhelm. It's different in that it is just pure rage. And as I've mentioned in previous episodes, I also got into very controlling friendships. And so I had a huge amount of rage directed towards whoever I was in a kind of an exclusive female best friend toxic relationship that I was in, which was a big theme in my teens. And I would basically fantasize about inflicting violence on these people, which of course made me a bad person, right? That's the only explanation for it. I also have a lot of memories of doing things to other people's property because as far as I remember, I don't remember inflicting physical violence on someone else, but I felt like I had opportunities to exert or express, I guess, some of this complexity that I was feeling around people's property, which I did not understand at the time of doing it. I had no idea at the time of doing it why I was doing any of these things. But I think when I was probably about seven, I think I was probably about maybe even younger, because I remember being on my reins that used to be attached to me when we went out and about So I must have been really quite small when we lived in Wiltshire. And I remember the first time I stole something from a shop. And I'm not a big stealer of things because I'm way too terrified of getting into any kind of formal trouble. I was terrified of my dad, terrified. So anything that I did had to be quite low risk. And I always have been risk averse. I could not risk actually being caught doing any of the things that I did. Although I was very naive to a lot of things and only realised much later that it was very, very obvious that it was me doing a bunch of these things. So, yeah, I would steal very kind of low value, not really big deal things from shops, sometimes like not even the actual product, but I don't know, like a just something that wasn't meant to be taken, you know, maybe a little bit of like a fitting or a fixture or I remember like there being a plastic keyring on the loop of some jeans that were hanging and I was sitting under the cloak. Anyway, I would just take these things and then I would squirrel them away. And then that was like my big win. It was like magpie behaviour. I would just be like, I want that. Even if it was something I wasn't really interested in, I'm going to take that because I can, and then I'm going to hide it. And then that's awesome. I've done a thing that no one knows about. But I would also destroy other people's things and go through other people's things. And my sister was the victim a lot of the times in me going through her things. And I am aware of the fact that when I was very little, I really thoroughly destroyed her stamp collection, which makes me really sad. You know, there are lots of things that I don't remember doing that I was told as I was growing up. Or, you know, remember the time when Antonia did this or did that, you know, and she got into, it was always like getting into someone's stuff and wrecking their stuff. So, and I didn't have siblings my age. So I was, it was, you know, older, my sister who's 10 years older than me, and then adults in my life having this little gremlin kind of doing this weird stuff to their stuff. And I remember like one time we had some contractors who were converting our garage into a room, and one of them left a full packet of cigarettes out, and then they weren't around because they'd gone off on a lunch break or something. And I was just passing through, because I always managed to be, you know, passing through wherever there might be a bit of action to be had, a bit of opportunity. And I took all the cigarettes out of the packet, held them in my two hands, twisted them so that they all broke, and then just like left them on the side. And I remember doing that, and I must have been 8, because that's when we moved into that house and that's when we had that work done. But I had no concept that it would be really obvious that I had done that. And then being kind of confronted about it by my mum, because obviously it was really obvious that I had done that. And then lying, obviously, being like, no, that wasn't me. And then my mum being like, well, I know it was you. I know it was you. Like, literally, who else could it have been? And them, you know, her sort of having to attribute it to something, some kind of belief that I had. So she kind of assumed that it was because I thought it was really dangerous and harmful for people to smoke, and I was trying to protect his health. So that was very much her coping mechanism, trying to come up with reasonable explanations for my really horrifying actions. And just loads of stuff, you know, I'd break, if I could get away with it. We had this beautiful desert rose stone in the house, and I remember breaking off a little bit of that just because I could, just because I could, you know, just destroy a thing. So I've just got lots and lots of memories like that, and also just lying for the sake of it, always looking for opportunities, really. So the main theme, really, now that I look back, was that I felt very much that I had no control, and I wanted a lot of control, and My dad was unusually high demand. My dad was very, he pushed me to achieve about as much as a parent in, you know, UK society is going to push a child. Anything that he thought I had potential in, and I know the reason he did it, because he saw a lot of potential in me, and he believed in me, and he wanted me to go all the way in whatever I did. And so anything that I showed a glimmer of potential in, unless it was something he disapproved of, he would push that just as far as it could go. So whether I enjoyed the thing or not. And so the big thing that dominated my life was pure demand. Not one single enjoyment aspect of this thing was excelling at playing the violin. And I actually have got to the point now where I can't listen to violin music. It makes me so angry to encounter anything violin related, because it was so extreme and I had to practice, you know, most evenings after school when I was exhausted, and then he used to get angry and I used to get angry, and I had to play in the orchestra every Saturday and I led the orchestra and I had to do all of this until I had done all of the exams. So I did the grade 8 and I led the orchestra, and then I quit when I was 17. So I was kind of, I think the reason that it's taken me so long to kind of get to internalized PDA is because actually I did have an unusually high demand life, but I still don't think it's proportionate to my coping mechanisms. There's other spooky stuff as well I want to mention. So I also started having strong obsessive belief stuff, and also extreme escapist fantasies and daydreams, which get called maladaptive because they are an adaptive behaviour that is not particularly healthy, although I do actually think it's proportionate to experience. So I think when you don't have any control, you don't have any autonomy, especially as a child, you have no choice but to make use of whatever survival mechanisms you've got available to you. All you can really do is try to reduce the harm that you inflict on yourself or other people. And so I think it's inevitable that you end up going hard dissociating, going very, very, very far away into some quite spooky places. So from about, again, age 8, I was starting to have real spooky nighttime stuff where I didn't sleep because I think my body was so wound up. I had so much cortisol in my body. I was so stressed. I was so exhausted. I couldn't sleep. And I would get lots of intrusive thoughts, particularly around very specific ways that I was going to die suddenly in my bed. I would obsess that my appendix was going to burst. I was obsessed with thrombosis and getting a blood clot, because my mum had mentioned that she had had a blood clot when she was very young. And I thought I was going to get deep vein thrombosis and get a clot in my brain or in my heart and die suddenly. I also was obsessed with religious figures, the Virgin Mary, and I believed that there were lots of things that I believed were I was going to inadvertently get pregnant, even though I was many years off becoming sexually active. I thought that things that got into my clothes, got into my underwear, were going to make me pregnant. Every time I went swimming, I was worried that there had been something in the water that would make me pregnant, that I would get pregnant by immaculate conception. I was terrified all the time that I actually was pregnant, and was like, how am I going to know? When am I going to know for sure? I used to feel the pulse, you know, there's a pulse somewhere around the sort of stomach, and be like, I don't think that's my heartbeat. I think that's a baby's heartbeat. So, and a lot of those obsessive things then became various types of deal making with God. Later, in a very naive, non-committal way, with darker forces as well, which I'm now basically realizing is some form of OCD, which I'm again only really realizing due to reading about other people's experiences, because I always thought of OCD as being the stereotype of OCD, and having to check on things a certain number of times. I am a checker, but that's because I know for a fact that I'm so distracted that I actually do leave things on or off, or doors unlocked, etc. So I think my checking is proportionate, but it was more like I had to find a way to light a candle and say a prayer a certain number of times. Yeah, often it was like I had to demonstrate my level of commitment to God, usually, in order to for these terrible things not to happen to me. Okay, so all of this very much hidden internal secret, which is why whenever I've seen PDA described, I always thought that's nothing to do with me. PDA descriptions are usually about children who are actively refusing to do things. They are finding creative ways to not get up in the morning, wash, get dressed, go somewhere, do a thing, do a task, whatever. They're finding ways to say no. So I have always seen those descriptions and thought, well, that's nothing to do with me, because I never said no to anything. In fact, I was the extreme opposite. So I became very keen on being perfect. I remember from probably about, age 9 or 10, just after we moved house, which was a very, very difficult experience for me. Moving to a new town, a new home, a new school was, again, something I've referred to as a highly traumatic time in my life. But actually, it was just moving house and moving to a new school and moving to a new town. For a lot of people, that's not highly traumatic. Even as an autistic person, that's not necessarily highly traumatic, but it was. And so from about that point, and I was starting to get into quite toxic friendships around that age as well, as I've described before, I started being really obsessed with being perfect, looking perfect, acting perfect, speaking perfectly, writing perfectly, spelling perfectly, dressing perfectly. Although my friends would always try to change everything about me, my preferences, unedited, were for extreme neatness, extreme orderliness. To the point where my posture was always perfect. I loved ballet because it was a very disciplined, physical pursuit. I liked the physicality of it, but I also liked the perfection of it. Aesthetically, just the discipline and the rigor around it. I definitely associate my obsession with perfection as linked to the beliefs and perceptions that were pushed very heavily in my household around thinness. I liked being a really thin child. And I liked wearing clothes that accentuated my thinness. and that like cinched me in. Now, part of that was sensory. I do know that. But I also very much liked the aesthetic because I think I had an internalized belief from my father that thin femininity is like the pinnacle of discipline and perfection. And I got a lot of reward from my father from being thin. A lot of positive regard. The violin playing, I was a bit like, well, if I'm going to have to play this thing, I'm going to have to be perfect. So I was not a musical person particularly. I love to dance, but I don't express myself musically. But I became a very strong technician and I learned all my music theory and I got my technical playing really down to a science and I became pretty good. And I was made the lead violinist in the youth orchestra that I played in. I couldn't speak to anyone. I was unbelievably anxious socially, but I was, you know, the best, if you like, at playing the violin. I made sure to get really high grades at school in the subjects that I could master. There were subjects that I couldn't even begin around, and I had a huge amount of shame around those. And I just sort of switched off from those really and found ways to balance out the shame of doing so badly in things like science and PE, which was a nightmare for me, with my excellent, you know, nationally high level grades that were like weirdly high grades in subjects like English literature and history and anything that involved essay writing, because I'm very good at essay writing. I became really obsessed with obedience and really obsessed with not getting into trouble. Getting into trouble was and remains my absolute worst nightmare. And I think this is really what all this perfection stuff stems from. I was terrified of adults, terrified of authority, and I'm still terrified of authority. And so perfection for me is not just the way to hide shame in the way that I've kind of learned about from Brené Brown and all of that. Perfection also protects me from adults and authority figures. So I could stay under the radar if I did everything that I was meant to. And if I avoided any interactions basically with adults and figures of authority. So it was completely unacceptable for me in my eyes to get any form of disciplinary action taken against me at school. So not at one of the schools I went to, we had detentions, but you had to get 3 debit points to get a detention. And I was once threatened with 1 debit point. In my entire school career, I was threatened with 1 debit point. And I didn't sleep for a few days because it was like just before a school trip. And so I was meant to be going to see this teacher when I came back from that school trip. And so the whole school trip, I basically had PTSD around the threat of this debit point. And all I could think about was debit point, debit point, debit point, debit point, debit point, debit point. I was literally, that's all I thought about the whole trip. And of course, that teacher had forgotten all about it. By the time I got back to school, they didn't remember that they'd threatened me with a debit point and you have to come and see me in the staff room. So I went to see them at the staff room. They were like, oh, yeah, can you just, you know, remember to keep your notebook in better condition or whatever stupid thing it was. So that was basically, that was my goal. That was my strategy. Stay under the radar, stay invisible, avoid authority figures at all costs. Be perfect, look perfect, make sure everyone thinks you're perfect. But under the radar, underneath all of that, I was finding I was finding ways to be extremely imperfect and destructive and do things in secret. And a lot of it was to do with these deals that I was making with God and, but I, yeah, kind of the devil, but I didn't, you know, it's not like I was following any particular belief system. I was just coming up with random stuff. And yeah, that's kind of also when I got into addictive things as well. So binge eating, in particular, I used to rearrange my room a lot, which I know is associated with ADHD and wanting novelty, but I also think it's an act of control. To be kind of having control over your environment is the only thing I had control over. And I'm very lucky to have had my own bedroom, for sure. I think I would have been in a far worse state. And I actually think that a lot of what I've experienced is in the realm, the edge of psychosis in terms of how extreme some of these things were. And I don't think they're hugely different. And I think they're kind of in the same realm and the same spectrum. Okay, 42 minutes in and I've still got so much to say. So these experiences have haunted me and confused me and been secrets. And I would always look for ways to control before the big house move. I would look for ways to control my friends who I felt were kind of peer to me. Once I moved and I started being controlled by other people, that all went out the window. And I would just do spooky things all the time. I would leave secret notes instructing people that whoever found the note, I'd be instructing them to do something or not do something. There was always this kind of thing going on. So as a teenager, a lot of this slipped. My perfection went out the window, really. I was dirty. I was messy. I was burned out. My body changed. I put quite a bit of weight on from the binge eating. My mother became more distant. My father became more critical. He had less control over me as a teenager, but there was a lot more expression of, I don't like you. I don't like you. I don't like looking at you. I don't like the way you behave. I don't like the way you act. I don't like the way you talk. I don't like the things you do. And I was so resentful and so angry with him in my teens that we would just throw this at each other quite a lot. You know, he would do something controlling towards me. I realised I wasn't physically scared of him anymore because he was a small man and I was, you know, I realised I was the same height as him. He was still definitely stronger than me. But I also knew that even though he was quite physically aggressive when I was little, I did know that he had no intention of intentionally hurting me physically. And so as a teenager, I think that kind of awareness of, well, I mean, we would literally get into quite a problematic physical fight if he expressed himself in that way with me. So we got very verbal and I would push it because, of course, I was wanting my father to say, oh, my love, I wish we could find a way to resolve this and be a loving father and daughter. What can we do to reconnect? But that never happened. So I would say to him, I don't like you. You're controlling. You're mean to me. You're mean to my mum. You're this, you're that. And he would just throw it straight back at me and be like, well, it goes both ways. I don't like you particularly. Look at the way you're dressed. He had such problems with the way I dressed. Because I was also discovering that I was a queer teenager and I was wanting to be a lot more androgynous and I liked grunge aesthetic. So it was just a constant fight to see what I could get away with, which wasn't much because he was very strict, very controlling. Okay, so then I became an adult, right? And I just always felt like I had these two beasts at war within me. One was the perfect girl, and one was a highly destructive, highly avoidant, highly escapist beast. And it really has been very hard to live with myself, and it's not been a particularly straightforward experience for my husband, who I've been with now for 23 years either. He's very generous and kind when remembering, you know, our earlier years and my 20s, but I know that I was a highly controlling partner, and my demand avoidance was really quite extreme. And so I, you know, lots of shame around this. You know, he has taken responsibility for a lot of things that I wouldn't take responsibility for when we were younger, and I'm still struggling with now, and I'm very, very late catching up, and I will never be able to pay him back, literally financially, but in other ways. I will never be able to give back what I didn't do for us in those times. And how dependent I've been. And, you know, adult life is working life. So I've had some really, really hard, confusing, complicated experiences in my various jobs. And I've had a huge range and combination of managers, you know, authority figures with different management styles, different leadership styles. Some I've gelled really well with, others I thought I gelled really well with, but actually I was having a massive trauma response to, and fawning and doing all of my perfection and my obedience, but at the same time unraveling underneath that in ways that are unsustainable. And I realised as an adult that I was starting to become more addictive and spending a lot of money and being very fixated on kind of escapist pursuits. And also just having this feeling of, I just becoming aware of this underlying feeling of, I feel trapped. I've always felt trapped. I'm always going to feel trapped unless I literally run away to live in a field or live on a boat in the middle of the ocean, or, you know, unless I take some kind of extreme action, which would be very antisocial, especially as a married person. And I don't actually want to leave my home or my marriage, my beautiful home, my beautiful husband, my beautiful cats. I don't want to go anywhere, but I've got this underlying permanent feeling of, when am I going to basically have total freedom? When am I going to feel free? And that was the state that I was in when I came across the concept of internalized PDA. And I read this little description about, actually, PDA doesn't only look like children kicking and shouting and making up stories and reasons that they can't go to school and being very expressive about it and refusing to do things. It can also look like all of the literal exact things that I have just described to you in this episode. And I read a little description of my life, and that is internalized or highly masked pathological demand avoidance. And the reason for it is actually, it's a response to, and yes, this is all a trauma response, but the trauma is not created by an event or anything, you know, traumatic in bunny ears. The trauma from PDA is pathological. It is basically a human born with such an extremely responsive nervous system and brain that the majority of experiences are experienced as a demand, or in my view, more than a demand. I actually think it should be called pathological threat perception, because the avoidance bit is the outcome, you know, whether it's maladaptive daydreaming, you know, controlling people, stealing things, any of those things. Yes, okay, they're the avoidant actions, behaviours, coping strategies, but the actual experience in the body is extreme threat. And so from the moment you're born, probably in the womb, everything you experience, whether it's sensory, whether it's, you know, the difficulties with autistic and non-autistic communication, but actually just very mundane, day to day, you have to wake up and open your eyes. You have to wake up and sit up. You have to stand up and get out of bed. You have to do one single thing. Anything you have to do, anything, is experienced as a threat in the body. And so apparently, and one of the things that never added up for me as an autistic person was apparently I was a very placid baby, very easy baby. And I always thought, well, how could I have been such an easy baby when I have such strong sensory needs and I was an undiagnosed autistic baby, child? And apparently it's really common in PDA babies who just literally are born dissociated. You arrive into this world, checked out. And so you're placid. People can do whatever they like to you. And you'll be extremely obedient and you'll be perfect. But the older you get, the more ways you will find to balance out. And that is what PDA is all about. All of these controlling, defiant, if you like, reactions are all about trying to find balance with the extremity of the stress from the threat being experienced. So now I'm 43 and I am married to a wonderful, responsible person who looks after us and creates a beautiful home. And I love him so much. He's literally the sweetest, gentlest, funniest, most handsome, wonderful person. If you follow my Instagram, you will have seen him recently. He's called Tristan and I love him so much. And he is still with me by some miracle, which I'm just trying to learn to accept. Everything that I've done, everything I've put him through, he's taken like a champ and seems to not think it's a big deal, which is a miracle. But I'm at this point in my life. I'm also, you know, I need to earn. I have to accept that. I have to accept that I have to do a job and earn money. It is like being tortured. But I am in a highly fortunate position. Highly, highly, highly fortunate and privileged. And so I am doing everything I can to just appreciate that and be grateful for that. I have great job security. I work with fantastic people who are very accepting of me, and I don't even care. I trust them so much. If any of them listen to this, I feel safe. And I think they understand why I talk about this stuff. It's really important. It's really important to talk about this stuff. So my goal now is to find, is to accept the fact that I have to find ways to balance out the control and the threat perception issues with having enough control myself, and to find healthy, non-destructive ways of finding that balance. I'm glad and I'm grateful that I didn't have children. That was the right instinct. I think that would have pushed me way over the edge. and my rage responses would have been a problem. And I've always instinctively known that. And I'm realizing now that's not because of being an autistic person. That is because of having been an undiagnosed autistic person with a PDA profile. I'm very, very clear about this. And if I had had children not knowing any of that and not having figured out the safe, non-destructive coping methods, and maybe I wouldn't have found enough balance if I'd had children. Or maybe it just would have been just desperately hard. So for me personally, I think it was the right move. I'm coming to accept that I need to have a massive amount of autonomy around whatever I'm doing. So there's no point me working for someone from this point onwards who has a very specific idea of what they want to have happen, how they want it to be, how they want it done. I need to set my own agenda, and I need to do things in my own way. I need to be in charge, fully in charge, as far as is feasible within the realm of my, you know, responsibility and my remit in a job. So being employed is hard. Being employed is very hard. I wish I had found a way to become self-employed right from the get-go, but I wouldn't have had the security and the benefits that I have. So I'm fortunate at the moment that I have a massive amount of autonomy, a huge amount of trust instilled in me. I know I'm an effective person at what I do. So I've got the conditions that I need currently. And I need acts of autonomy, which is what I call it. And they need to be really benign things that don't cost money, because I owe it to my home and my family and my husband not to waste money anymore. They need to not be too spooky, because that path is not healthy for me. And they need to not distract too much from my responsibilities and my work. So I've come to realise actually that my acts of autonomy include things like making this podcast. The fact that I am telling my truth into the world and no one can stop me and no one's going to stop me is the ultimate act of autonomy for me. And I think that's why I'm so driven to do it. Same goes for my Instagram reels. I do a couple of those every day, partly because things are coming through that I want to communicate. Or coming up rather for me, but also because every time I do one, it feeds that need for balance as an act of autonomy. I've got my little Tetris game that I play a couple of times a day on my short break. I've realised it's really worth me waking up a long time before I have to get up in the morning, so that I can either lie there doing nothing, staring into space, or I can do some scrolling, or I can read about something I want to read about, or I can go downstairs and do a few things in the house on my terms, and because I don't have to. I'm much more likely to do tasks if I don't have to do them. And I'm trying to inflict as little control on other people as possible by finding balance in better ways. And I think I've made a lot of progress, and I'm very, very proud of myself. And I think if you have been through anything like what I have been describing, and trying to find more sustainable ways that are less destructive, then I think you should be extremely proud of yourself as well. And I'm going to end on that note, and I really hope that that was a useful episode. Feel free to write to me. I'm slow replying to emails because PDA, haha. But I do love hearing from people. I love it. And I will come back to you at some point. I just get overwhelmed by demands. I'm quicker on Instagram. If you message me on Instagram, I'm way quicker. There's something for some reason that is just way less of a threat demand reaction for me on Instagram. Okay, take care. Love you lots. Why not? Love you loads. Take care. Bye-bye.